the first CineStory podcast. CineStory is a non-profit organisation nurturing screenwriters through its contest, retreat and fellowship programs. Find out more about this creative community at cinestory.org. This podcast was recorded at a live event in Los Angeles in 2011. Here, Andrew Zinnes of Filmmaker Junction interviews CineStory mentor and pro screenwriter Mark Fergus. Mark and his writing partner, Hawk Ostby, won the CineStory Screenwriting Awards in 1999 with their script, First Snow, which Mark went on to direct, starring Guy Pearce. In 2007, Mark and Hawk were nominated for an Academy Award for Children of Men. They have since worked on blockbusters such as Iron Man, Cowboys and Aliens, and the upcoming Akira. The first voice you'll hear is that of Willie Hagen, another CineStory winner and board member, giving a brief introduction to the organization.
I've got about 2 minutes to speak to you, and I realize that you guys have a really good hand out that explains everything I was going to say. You had a really good article written about Mark, which explains everything I was going to say. So I will try to be quick. CineStory is a nonprofit, as you've read, that is aimed at developing screenwriters. Its two claims to fame are its contest, which I think personally is as good as any of them out there. I include Nichols, Austin, all that, but it's not as well known.
Well, cash is good, and we don't give out the highest amount of cash. I think what our program gives out is even better for aspiring writers. We have a 4-day retreat, and for a winner, a finalist, or a semi-finalist, we invite them to the retreat. The winner, we pay everything. The finalist, we pay partial, and the rest of you can enter and applicate on your own. But it's well worth it. For that 4-day period, you have 3 90-minute one-on-one sessions with mentors, and the mentors are industry professionals. Mark has been a mentor. Mark also won the contest. Could I sit here and say that CineStory made him the man he is today? Absolutely. Mark, like a lot of writers, brings their own talent there, but CineStory provides an opportunity for access to meet agents, producers, other writers, but it also gives you a very honest and frank assessment of your writing.
Did this, we did First Snow, mm-hmm. And then chronologically was Children of Men before Iron Man?
Children of Men we wrote before this. We did our drafts. It was like our second job ever out of just as working writers. That was a job over at Beacon that was, you know, we were new guys and we were, our first script was for a Philip K. Dick novel, and we had done some cool stuff with that. So we kind of quickly became the guys who you go to when the genres are all mixed. There's no clear, it's not an action movie, it's not a drama,
right,
it's not,
yeah.
So we get all the ugly ducklings, as it were, which is good. That was our niche. And Children of Men was this book that they had. And you know, I didn't, it was just really not, it wasn't on anybody's list of hot projects in development. It was sort of this, beautiful, weird little P.D. James novel, very different from her other stuff, and we walked in and we immediately said, this is Casablanca. This is like, this is not in the book, but what we got to do to get this to be a movie is go in and pitch it like a trailer, pitch it, you know, because they this book is, it's, you know, they're like, it's British and it's dour and it's really depressing. Everyone's jumping in on the trains all the time and it's really just raining all the time. It's gray. It's, there's no children anywhere. It's like, who wants to see this movie? You know, that's how everyone was looking at it, and this is why we got offered the assignment. I think, you know, it was not an A-list. So what we really saw that, you know, the opportunity was Casablanca because, you know, none of the characters were set up that way in the book, but what you had was, you know, a guy who had already laid down and died, kind of given up on the world, and the woman who hurt him the most comes back into his life and needs his help for a larger cause,
mm-hmm.
a political cause, in this case, you know, much bigger cause. And he has to put aside all of this personal turmoil to help, essentially, you know, he goes on to help save the world, but he has to start off as someone who's already given up on the world and given up on himself and, you know, hates this woman almost who needs him. And And so we went in and pitched it as Casablanca, and that's, you know, Casablanca is never a bad thing to say in a pitch meeting, by the way. if you make them see material through other eyes, they're like, that, they hadn't heard that, and they said, okay, this could actually be a movie and not just a, something on a development pile. And so it was crucial to kind of really activate it and find something that would make them really see it, because this thing was had no momentum anyway, and so we wrote our draft really based on a woman and a man who had known each other, who had been activists, who had been political, and you know, wanted to change the world, and then the world gets hit with this affliction, this curse. They have a personal tragedy, it breaks them apart, and the guy doesn't know what, he doesn't really, you know, all his ideals are worth shooting now. Why fight for a world that's going to die out anyway? We're not going to, the species is screwed, we're doomed. And so he just kind of wilts, you know. And we wanted to, it reminded me a lot of Rick in Casablanca, which he just has essentially done everything but lay down and die. He just has given up on the human spirit. And to have that guy, you know, we really responded to that one in the images. We said that these are the images that are going to be in the movie if this ever gets made. And one of them was, you know, and it's a really beautiful way that it ultimately came out. But a really ordinary guy, just broken and completely shattered by the end of this movie. But he has in fact saved the world. But he's doomed. He's not going to make it through this. And that was the. Not in the book either. And then the first thing he said, this has to really be a self-sacrifice story. The most selfish, self-absorbed asshole at the beginning who doesn't care about anybody or anything anymore, to a guy who's
selfless,
who puts it all on the line, including his own life, to give humanity another shot. And that was the movie we pitched, and that's what, you know, ultimately got made. It had a hell of a journey to continue going through. Alfonso Cuarón got thank God for Harry Potter, because he had such a success with that they let him make this
perfect, right?
They let him make this crazy ass, you know, independent film for $70 million or whatever. And
did you get to meet with him and talk with him?
We had an interesting. I mean, he's a very brilliant guy, but. He's one of those directors who the project starts with him and isn't really one of. Nothing before him matters, or you know, and that's just par for the course. I mean, that's a lot of the creative process. When a director comes on, it's now the project starts. I'm like, you know, this is from a novel by Peter. No, nothing mattered before that. But in any case, really brought that film beautifully to life. But that was one where you know, as you're pitching it, you see. You know, the images that did actually make it all the way through to the film, which was, to me, the seminal images in that were, you know, a pregnant woman who is revealing herself to our hero for the first time, and of course he has no way to process that other than a sexual advance, and she needs something from him, so he misinterprets the moment completely. What she's telling him is that she's pregnant, and when we wrote that, we were like, that's got to be a purely visual moment. You just have to. And I don't know, by the time the movie came out, everyone kind of knew what it was about, but we wrote it as if no one would have any idea that was what it was about. And, you know, just bring this child, give this child a chance. And that was really the when you say, like, how do we structure, like he, you know, when we pitched this idea, this is the ending. This is the guy who dies to save this one child, and he starts as a guy who, you know, would pickpocket you pretty much, and that gives you such a distance to go that you can now you have like a way to build a structure around something. That's sort of how we approach it when you can go from those polar opposites. And same with Iron Man, you know, the biggest jackass in the world to a guy trying to be a hero, not particularly great at it, but then your structure falls into place. There's so many stages along the journey to somebody being selfish and petty, to being selfless and really understanding that it's not about your life, it's about, you know, those around you. Even, you know, This was a stranger to him. In our script, it was actually his ex-lover who was carrying the child. So it was
Alice's ex-lover.
No, Julianne Moore's character.
Oh, right.
Was actually pregnant woman. So it was a very different choice he made there. But same emotional trajectory completely, because she sort of took over the responsibility for when she enters the story, it's like you're not responsible for her, because she was under Julianne Moore's, that was her protector, and now you're her protector. So he made a really interesting different choice there. And that's one of those things where you read it and you're like, and then you see it and you fall into the filmmaker's vision. It was so powerfully, you kind of don't think of all the things that you wanted, that you had, set out a specific way. Even, some things you think were better, some things you think, wow, I wish I thought of that. And it's really cool to as many times as you're disappointed with where your stories end up, you're more often, you're pretty excited about what other people brought to it, even if you wouldn't have agreed at the beginning. So.
Did you get rewritten on this one?
Yeah, this was, we adapted the novel, and then Alfonso and his writing partner did the production draft, and then there's a studio writer in between, David Arata. So one of the nice things, especially, there's so many nightmare experiences, this was, every writer put their layer on building on the next day. It wasn't a destructive, like, tearing down. And so when I read the production draft, I you still saw your script, your structure right in there, and I was so, and they liked it, and they kept it, and they built on it, and they did some fantastic. I thought that the choice to go into that prison camp at the end to compress the drama into this tiny space where they could be caught, whereas we had them flee out into the country. So that was a great choice. That was like, now put it in a crucible and put it in a vice and just twist. So you just see some amazing things come out of being rewritten. And just as often as we have been rewritten, we've rewritten others. I think it's only wrong if rewriting is a necessity, because most scripts, I would never take a job that I thought a script was good. We've turned down gigs that were like, this is good. I mean, like, all you'd be doing is tearing it down to see if you can put it in a different arrangement. Basically, it's a paycheck, and for all the wrong reasons.
But
most scripts that we get that are rewrite jobs are not not ready to be movies yet, or they went in a certain way, and we really have a different idea, and we want to burn it down, or we won't even read the original draft. So we feel like... there's some method to. I was a little cynical about the system until you get in there and you realize most movies. I wish that producers would stick with the original writer and say, this isn't ready yet, but let's go and let's as a team go find it together. Clint Eastwood, I said, like, I'll work with the writers that I hired and we'll get there. That I wish was the prevailing wisdom. It's not, unfortunately, but. You will rewrite others and try to make their work better, and they believe me, you will be rewritten as well. So it's not, it all comes back around.
Is there anything else you wanted to show on this? Otherwise, that's
no. That's
good. Iron Man.
Yeah.
And that's so fun.
Yeah. That's.
So how did that come about? So now we're talking Marvel. We're talking about as big and popcorny as you can get. Big actors.
Yeah. Well, everybody, I mean, it was kind of an ugly duckling again, which these are the ones we get. We don't get we get ones that need Marvel was their first thing out of their own studio. Are we making a giant arc movie here? Because we had, we didn't have a lot of action, we had a lot of talking scenes, we had a lot of, and we had this amazing, actor, not movie star, yet,
right.
At least, nobody knew that he was going to be... I didn't know if he would have that chemistry with audiences the way Johnny Depp does, and clearly, yeah, he does. But that was the first time anybody gave that him that kind of a shot to prove that. So it was one of those ones that it was far from, they had a script in tatters, you know, from day one, so we came in to just basically start over in pre-production, start the script over.
In pre-production?
Yeah, start over and write like a banshee and write every day for the entire shoot, all 24/7 writing, rewriting, all the way through, and being on set every day. And that's just right, but the movie was made like in really great controlled chaos, where it was everybody was scared that we didn't know what we were doing, and we were just you were firing on all cylinders, because nothing was assured. I mean, Iron Man was not really on the A roster of Marvel characters. It was kind of like starting to dig down to the Ant-Man territory. And I used to go to Starbucks every day in Hollywood and Highland. No, that the one in and they had the giant Marvel billboards out, and people would be making fun of Iron Man like for months before he came out. And I would listen to their, you know, crappy character, no way Downey is going to look pull off the suit, nothing. And I was just listening to the guys behind the counter mocking the movie, and I was like, oh shit, you know, this is scary, because I don't know if anyone's going to...
They're really visceral fans, right?
Yeah. And so it was really unsure experience, but it just had one of those things where good things happen, and everybody's a little scared, everybody's a little out of depth, and things... You know, you work so much harder when you got something to prove like that, and everybody did on that one. So I think everybody came together like wanting to kick ass and not knowing what that was going to take. So you get out whatever you think your A game is, and you just work your ass off, and everybody did on that one. So it was cool. It was real, and Marvel is an untested studio, and everybody had that level of, you know, adrenaline going. Just a notch below sheer panic, but it's not, it's like, it's where you do your best work, you know, right in that level where, and everybody just did it, and it's fun to look back and think that we were on to something, but man, at the time, you're just trying to get the scene to work every day.
Did Favreau give you any kind of notes? Did he give any directions, or did he give you directions?
Yeah, he was pretty open, but he, you know, what we sensed with him is he, you know, the guy is ridiculously smart. I don't think he doesn't wear that on his sleeve. Like, he isn't talking like an intellectual. He's ridiculously intellectually smart and has like the whole history of storytelling memorized. And you know, he really gave you a ton of freedom, but also basically said, I'm raising the bar pretty high here. I don't want, you know, when we write kind of stock scenes or stock action building, you see, you know, he would let us know that we're trying to do something. Not, we don't want to just live in the territory where these movies are comfortable. Let's try to, if we're going to fail, let's fail like big and then really raise the bar on these movies and try to make them intelligent and try to make them whatever. And so what he did, he didn't tell us what to do, but he set a spirit of class and, you know, I don't even know if that's the right word, just that we were going to try to do something cool and elevated, not schlock, and not, don't ever take the easy route, and he gave us that kind of rope to play with, so you I mean, John Robert would trash your scenes on a daily basis. I mean, just, and you had to laugh at it, because, you know, he's got to carry this movie on his shoulders more than anyone. He's the one who, you know, is really, really out there on the tightrope. We're all going to work again, because we're a non, no one cares about a writer. You know, we can hide, and, you know, directors can hide. You know, Robert can't hide. He's out there wearing a ridiculous, you know, plasticky-looking suit. He's got to go out there and make you believe in Tony Stark and Iron Man. So he was awesome, but he would totally bust your ass, like, every day that, you know, the scene. And even a scene that would end up being shot exactly as written, you know, you'd go through 4 or 5 days or 4 or 5 hours, whatever, of hell, rearranging it, rewriting it, tearing it up, whatever, and sometimes you'd end up doing exactly what was written. Sometimes a line would change, sometimes 2 lines would flip, but he needed to commit to stuff his own way, so he wasn't being a pain in the ass, he just wanted to, you know, it was kind of a game, and it was kind of fun, and even when, you know, he hated the scene, and it was in the spirit of we're all trying to make a good movie here, so he was hard on us, and we were really hard on them. I mean, we he likes to improvise. He wasn't telling the story. We would be the first jerks to go in there and say, you know, the scene, we still had, all this stuff is fantastic, all these fantastic zingers and improvs and games that are being played. We still haven't told the scene. The story cannot move forward if we didn't do this piece that we need to do. And we have to get this piece of physical business or action or dial or whatever. This hasn't been serviced yet. I know it's boring, Robert, but this is the story. We need this piece to go to the next thing. So you would, you know, you got a good cop, bad cop, and John's brilliant because he stands back and just lets it all happen. You know? Great director because he hires well and he just kind of he lets the drama happen over there, and he gets, he knows what's going on. He's just
one of the things when I remember watching it, scene, what I thought was elevating it was a lot of the bickering that went on between Gwyneth and Tony Stark. And I was like, did they write that, or was that improv? Because it felt to me, I could have gone either way, actually. Yeah. It's like, that's either great writing and they're just riffing on it, or, you know,
That's exactly it. It was great writing and they were riffing on it.
And that's why it was like, spare something.
Yeah, it was a tightrope for them to walk on. They, you know, you can't, if John is loves that kind of rat-a-tat anyway, he's created that. And you have actors who are so capable of you know, the Girl Friday kind of, you know, back and forth. So, yeah, you just, those are the scenes where you just write a clothesline to make the scene work, and then you just let them go.
Right.
You know, you let them go crazy, because they'll find crazy shit that you've never, you know, and they'll get so into the rhythm of it that they'll find that kind of. So, yeah, it was written, but it wasn't nearly as fun as what you see. Didn't have that kind of interrupting, and then Robert will just pull something out of nowhere. He has these like images or strange ways of twisting a line or twist play on words. He just out of nowhere those come, and you know, our favorite thing. And when we'd write a scene, and then he would expand upon it like in the moment without even telling anyone. He would just sort of riff on it, which he did.
What are your thoughts about writing villains?
I think they have to be more interesting. They have to be more interesting and more right than the hero. We definitely think that, I totally agree. The villain and your hero is only going to be as good as the thing that's smashing up against them. We like to make the heroes, the villains, you know, not only like the, oh, if it was a movie, if it was their movie, they'd be the hero. But it's they have to be have a dangerous point of view on the world, but they are right. They're absolutely right. And they're actually convinced, and they have conviction that the hero wishes he had. In this movie, you know, Jeff Bridges knows what he's about. Tony doesn't know what he's about. And you get to kind of, you know, have a villain who really has a huge worldview and a really enlightened perspective given what people are and given what humanity, like, you know, a real philosopher's kind of view of things. He just, you know, nobody wants the medicine that he's prescribing, but he's not wrong about what's wrong with the world.
Right.
And then you have an interesting villain, and then I think cool actors will, if you have a guy just frothing at the mouth, like throwing lightning bolts at little puppies, you know, then it's, okay, he's the villain, it's stupid, and people tune out for that. You're not going to get good actors, I think, to play, you know.
Lightning bolts.
Yeah. I mean, my thing was, for this was to, you know, I really, and man, I can't believe he said it and stayed in the movie. I wanted Jeff Bridges to call Tony's technology the Ninth Symphony, you know, and because he really felt like this was a thing your whole, you know, before I kill you, this is a thing your whole life has been leading up to, and it's a masterpiece of technology, blah, blah, blah. And I think that's the kind of villain he was. He was, you know, he started playing the piano, and once he, I'm like, oh, Jeff's playing piano. He just started improvising, and I was like, and I forgot, Fabulous Baker Boy, he's a great piano player. I just totally, he was so in a different character, I forgot it was Jeff completely.
Right.
But villains, I think, it's a missed opportunity if they're just a generic force of, you know, bad things in the story. It's a waste. You know, it should be some shadow version of the hero, absolutely, and some an aspect of them that they're trying to exercise, and I felt like this was, you know, Tony's father is dead, but this is his surrogate dad, and he has to kill his own dad to, you know, this is the guy who wants him to stay unevolved and unenlightened, and to get to this next place he's going to be in life, he's got to get through this person, which means he's got to kill him.
Let's open it up, because we're coming, we're just seeing how what time it is now. Questions from the audience, from Mark. There must be one or two out there.
I have a question. Did you enjoy the experience of directing First Snow? And after that, did you then think, would you prefer writing or in having somebody like John Favreau come over and take over a project, or you yourself do it?
Yeah, I loved it, and I would love to do it again. There's not, I mean, I was very lucky to find a company, the Ari Film Group, that was kind of taking chances on first-time people, and Bob was a very adventurous soul with, you know, we wanted to do cool, I mean, he won the Oscar the first year out with Crash. I mean, he was just doing stuff that no one else was doing at the time, and there's not, you know, so I had a lot of help being able to do the film I wanted. Then we got kind of distracted, I mean, you know, woo-hoo, but we suddenly had a writing career that was taking off. I'm like, all right, you know, we should really see where that goes, which didn't leave enough time. But I really would love to just go back, and I wouldn't want the pressure of what a guy like John has to carry for a studio film. That's insane, the amount of plates they have to spin and how many people they have to negotiate to get a good movie made. But I just love those tiny, weird movies that you kind of, the budgets are small enough where no one is terrified of you taking nutty chances. So I would love to do it again. I think it's one of those things now that technology is there, so you really have to make your own game. Or there's not a lot of people making smaller films out there. And that budget range that I like is just a no man's land of it's not big enough and it's not small enough, so kind of caught in between. But the tech, you know, again, I go back to In the Company of Men, and I look at the quality of the writing and the acting, and you do it on a canvas that's not impossible with a low budget or a no budget. You make the limitations make you write better, to contain it physically, so it's not it's a production you can actually pull off. So I would love to do that again. Any time, it is the great. It's totally different, but it makes you a better writer. Just like doing acting classes makes you a better writer. It's all everyone. You don't think of scenes ever the same way again, or you finally, at long last, learn to write less and less and less because you realize the scene doesn't need what you're given. You don't need to write so much to get the moment across. You need to pick better, choose better, but you don't have to write a lot of words. I think it's all been really good for the writing.
And you're back there.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship with the producer? And kind of, I don't know, whether who's your favorite, why, or, you know, what's a classic mistake that you've come across from a producer?
What I learned on my first film is pick producers really well, because it's not just a side consideration. I had some good producers. I had some others that I didn't click with, but anybody I didn't click with, I mean, we're talking like the vision for the movie didn't click, and it was my responsibility to know that before I hired them. Just like your DP, just like your Alec, you know, you're spending so much time on those positions as if the producer thing is not really important. It's just as important. So it falls to the director. Some producers don't get to choose. They come with the project like luggage, you know, lots of it, you know. Keeps on falling. As the project goes further, you get more and more, you know, people with it. But some you can choose, and you have to know who those people are. So I would say that you got to hire people who see the same movie that you do. And I lucked out, because Bob Yari, who was financing it as well, really liked our vision and really supported it. So anyone who didn't support it, as long as he did, he was the top of the food chain. He was the king. And I had some scuffles down, you know, with producers, and Bob took care of those. He fought for me, and usually you get the executive producer, the money guy, they're the bad guy. You know, I had an exec producer who was fighting for me, and if I believed in what I was doing, he would get on my side and he would make that issue something we could deal with and have that producer step aside and let me finish the movie he wanted to do. So that was lucky. I could have ended up one of those directors who get out on the ledge when your film's taken away from you, you're locked out of the room, you have your director's period, once that's over, they can chuck you right out of there, hire a new editor and cut the film they want. And that's the kind of thing that would make you never want to direct again, because it would rip your heart out. I was really fortunate with a producer like Bob not to have to face that, you know, for good or ill. If the film's good, it's the movie we wanted to make. If it sucks, it's our fault. It was the movie we wanted to do, and he backed us up. So put a lot of thought into the producers. I think some people say, hey, I'm interested in your film, let's work together. And you know, we're so excited to hear anybody say something cool that you want to jump right into bed with this person who just showed interest. Now, they may be totally the wrong person, but it's really hard to turn away from somebody who says, hey, I can move the ball forward for you, but beware is all I would say. Make sure that they have the same movie in mind. And it's almost like take them out to lunch and talk about life, not even movies, and see what kind of person they are. Then you'll know, okay, this is the right sensibility. We made some mistakes in that area not because we had to, because we were lazy in that one regard and didn't do our homework all the time. So.
For someone who's never pitched anything, talk more about the pitching process and kind of sell something.
Yeah, pitching I hate more than anything. But I've learned to do it finally, because it is sort of always going to be a factor. But it's actually, again, you turn this horrible thing, stage fright, whatever. I don't have stage fright, but as you can probably tell, I have a hard time just crystallizing my thoughts or not, you know, wandering. I like to just, you know, just go wherever your brain takes you. But pitching has been, think of it as a way to distill your story down to the perfect, purest form it can be. You can't get it any more succinct. You can't get it any, you know, and so we're not talking about, when I pitched Children of Men, the worst pitch ever, because I didn't know how to pitch, and luckily they gave me the job, because I had to do it over the phone as well, and it was like, it was an hour long. It was ridiculous. I was going scene by scene, telling them a story, thinking, oh, won't they be impressed? I figured the whole story out. They'll love me. Meanwhile, they probably shut off, you know, I'd be surprised if half of the people were listening by the end. You're there to blow their minds with a movie trailer is kind of the way to look at it. Go in with it doesn't have to be complete. You don't have to figure everything out. All you have to do is plant a couple of great ideas in their head. The sweep of the character, you know, the main character, the sweep of the actor in the broadest terms possible. But you really want to, basically, when you walk out of a movie theater after seeing 10 shows, you know what movie you want to see. And that's what a pitch should be. It's just, you're there to blow their minds. You're not there to speak to their intellectual brain, because that's where I can't tell you how many times I did that. People don't want to be told stuff. They don't want you to be bored. They don't want to be bored. I used to type up these elaborate documents and leave them behind, 20-page screeds about, you know, like, look, I figured it all out, hire me. I doubt they ever read it, and if they did, they probably lost me the job, because you've given them too much to object to. Just go in and blow their minds 5, 6, 7 minutes, like, it, as ridiculously short as you can make it. And I think Goldman, in that second book of his, has the greatest, you know, way to pitch. You just, you know, here's the big hook. You know, we came in with Children of Men. It's not a dry, boring, dreary British novel. It's Casablanca. In a Blade Runner kind of setting, it's like, it's about, you know, this guy who's going to save the world, you know, you get one chance to save the world, a guy who's dead inside ends up, you know, bringing humanity back. You know, you go in there with the big stuff and the ideas that they can't get out of their head. That's all they're going to remember anyway. So my thing now is leave everything else out. Just say what they're going to remember and walk out. Like, say, gotta go. Like, I got another meeting. And if they want, if they're interested, they'll stop you and ask a lot of questions. You should be prepared to answer, you know, the big stuff. But It sounds a little daunting because, like, as a writer, you want to explain the story to them. I can't tell you how. Just let yourself off the hook by knowing ahead of time that they're not listening. Once you start explaining the whole story, then they're going to start thinking about lunch or something. I've done it a million times, and you can see the shift or the glazed eye or the slight little turn look at the watch. And you know you lost them, but you go in and say, movie trailer, great hook, great concept, great character, a couple of awesome scenes, giving its general sense of what the movie's about in three acts, and you're out of there. And you know what? It will take you 10 times longer to prepare that pitch than it will to prepare the crappy long one. You got to think about what your story is, and you got to distill it and cook it till there's nothing left. The great news is if you get the job or if they say yes, you've now figured so much about your own story. So think of pitching as a way for you to confront whether you really know what your story is about yourself. Because as I found out, CineStory really knows this. Meg LaFoe would say, what's your story about? Tell me in a few sentences. No one could ever do it. I won the competition in 1999. I couldn't do it. But the script I won with, I had no idea how to do that. And she basically said, you got to know that. I'm sitting across the table from you. Tell me why I'm listening to you. And that's what she was talking about. And even if the story is subtle and complex and layered and all that, the pitch should be like telling, you know, a child something that blows their mind. It just has to be that compelling. And it'll take you a lot of time to get there.
I'm fracking my brain.
Yeah, but it's worth it because then you know what your story is for real.
So I just saw the trailer for Cowboys and Aliens.
Yeah, sorry about the title.
You know what it is?
I tried.
Well, the
it's actually
perfect.
About that title.
It's the graphic novel, yeah, that it's based on. I just thought.
Well.
Go ahead. I'm anticipating your question.
Well, it is about this blending of genres, which seems incredibly risky and creative too. And I'm just curious about the kinds of issues that came up. And
I think it was, and I didn't. You know, we were hired onto that, not knowing that. I thought we would get in the first crack at it. I had no idea that it had been around for a long time at different studios, different writers. Really good people had tried to do it, and it had been all over the place for 15 years or 10 years, a long time anyway. And we were just coming off Iron Man, and we got a chance to just, they just gave us the graphic novel and said, what would you do with this? And you know, I always remember watching those Spielberg interviews where he, you know, talked about what John Ford had taught him about directing when he got to meet him, and how I felt like Spielberg was kind of the heir to John Ford's legacy. For me, anyway, the really amazing, smart genre movies that were also, they were really smart and beautifully made, but they also seemed to speak to everyone, you know, and like he was a populist director. I don't know what exactly it is, but John Ford seemed like, I feel like that was Spielberg was the guy who then did that, And suddenly we get this piece of material that kind of says, oh, wait a minute, you those two sensibilities, like Close Encounters and The Searchers, what if you brought those together with no smirking and no irony and no cutesiness and no postmodern bullshit, none of that like mashup nonsense, like play it straight, play it completely honest. The way Spielberg took the you know, which was a pretty discredited genre by the time, of the alien visitation movie, I mean, it was kind of cornball, B movie stuff, and then he made Close Encounters. It's like this beautiful, honest, like wondrous thing about kind of something that would be considered silly. And so anyway, we saw it as a way to, what if we could do that for a Western that had, you know, do a Western, a real no BS Western in the John Ford vein, and then have sci-fi start to kind of creep in the way it did in Close Encounters. And bring those two genres together, which don't feel like they should. They do seem like they belong. Like they belong together. Or like some good version of those two should work, and that's what we got excited about. There's a really delicate chemistry there that can so easily go the wrong way, but in the hands that it's in, I think will be pretty incredible and cool. And I hope what it does is it catches people off guard because it is kind of risky and it is kind of, you haven't seen it indelibly done before, but you know, Star Wars is essentially a John Ford movie that at its heart, so we're not crazy, and the two genres are kind of already vetted out together in Star Wars and things like that. I think it will hopefully capture that kind of magic and not, but the title is just a good intention getting way to tell you what the movie's about. But
What title did you want?
It never even was a discussion. No, like Crimson in the Snow, I don't know, something like pretentious and like, you know, Unforgiven kind of, you know, heavy and westerny and cool, but it was never an option to mess with it, so that was fine. But I think it tends to make people drift towards, oh, is this supposed to be kind of a, you know, Mel Brooks movie or something? Is it supposed to be cute and ironic or something? And the answer is no, definitively no. And I hope that comes across. It will definitely come across in the movie. I hope that captures people's imagination.
One last question. Anybody? Go ahead.
Mark, you kind of mentioned this about Iron Man. You said the third act set piece, and you kind of implied that wasn't your favorite part of the film.
No, I think it's where you have to wrap things up. There was a much more elaborate act three that was planned and written, and some of it was shot, and there was a lot of stuff we wanted to do in there, and then it just kind of became time to wrap the movie up and get all the threads to connect.
Well, guys, well, I'd like to thank Mark for coming out.
Interested in attending a 4-day writer's retreat or being considered for the CineStory Fellowship? Enter the CineStory Screenwriting Awards at cinestory.org/contest. The final deadline for the 2012 contest is February 15th. The grand prize includes $5,000 cash, free attendance at the retreat, and a 12-month fellowship program. CineStory would like to thank Don Bowden for use of the track Home from his album This One's Gonna Leave a Mark. Don is a composer for film, TV, and other media. To find out more about his work, visit donbowden.com. Finally, CineStory is a non-profit organization, so if you like what you hear, consider supporting these podcasts by making a donation at cinestory.org/about and click on the Support Us page. Until next time, happy writing.